She served in the big house. He worked as a carpenter. They were in love. But in 1848, they couldn't marry without permission. They feared their future children would be ripped away from them and sold down the river. They were slaves, and slaves couldn't decide their own futures. The young lovers knew that there were activists up north, men and women fighting to abolish slavery.
No one knew when it would be abolished. It might be in a year, it might be in a decade, it might be in centuries.
This is the story of two people, William and Ellen Craft, who refused to wait, refused to suffer under slavery. This is the story of two people who took their fates into their own hands. Barbara McCaskill is the author of a new book on William and Ellen Craft.
Ellen was a house servant. She was, from a very young age, living in the big house under the watchful eye of white men and women. But she, like other African-American house servants, kept their ears open for information. They carefully and surreptitiously, secretively listened to conversations in the dining room, in the parlor. They listened to conversations that their owners had about the North.
William was frequently lent out to work on projects on other plantations, and he too listened to talk about the North among white and free black people who he met. By the winter of 1848, the couple had begun to form their own plan of escape.
Ellen decided to disguise herself as not only a man, but a gentleman Southern planter, the richest, wealthiest class of white man in the South at that time.
Ellen's father was a white man, and her lighter skin enhanced her disguise, but the pair couldn't take any chances.
She cut her hair. She wrapped a bandage around her face because she knew that she couldn't grow facial hair, which was very common on men at the time. She put on a suit of clothing, which she and William procured by hook and crook.
Lastly, William put Ellen's arm in a sling. Neither William nor Ellen could write, and the fake injury made for a perfect excuse. They planned to travel by train to Philadelphia, a four-day-long journey, using money that William had saved from doing extra carpentry work. William would play the part of Ellen's servant, while Ellen pretended to be a wealthy planter traveling north for medical treatment.
Compared to other African Americans who escaped, their risks were greater because the state of Georgia was so much farther away from the border between slavery and freedom. The majority of African Americans who escaped bondage successfully did so because they lived in border states. They knew that they would have to mingle with the enemy at every turn.
Finally, everything was ready. On December 21st, 1848, they stepped out of Ellen's little cabin for the very last time. These are the words that William used years later to describe those last moments in slavery. Though there were trees all around the house, yet the foliage scarcely moved. In fact, everything appeared to be still as death. I then whispered to my wife, "Come, my dear, let us make a desperate leap for liberty." But poor thing, she shrank back in a state of trepidation. I turned and asked what was the matter. She made no reply but burst into violent sobs and threw her head upon my breast. We both saw the many mountainous difficulties that rose one after the other before our view and knew far too well what our sad fate would have been were we caught and forced back into our slavish den. Therefore, on my wife's fully realizing the solemn fact that we had to take our lives, as it were, in our hands and contest every inch of the 1,000 miles of slave territory over which we had to pass, it made her heart almost sink within her.
They were literally walking into the abyss. Although they obviously had some idea of where they were going, what routes they would take, even where they might stay as far as hotels, they knew that their prospects, the risks of being caught, far outweighed the risks of making it to freedom.
And yet, somehow they found the courage to take the next step, and the next. And soon they were on a northbound train. From Macon, they traveled through Savannah, Charleston, Wilmington, Richmond, and Baltimore. Finally, they arrived in Philadelphia, and the first free state either of them had ever seen. Fearing recapture, they decided to venture even farther north, to Boston.
They found a thriving African-American community on Beacon Hill, with African-Americans representing all classes. And there were affluent African-Americans who had started businesses and who had thrived and who had accumulated some degree of wealth, much of which they funneled back into their community to support churches, schools, and in particular to support anti-slavery societies.
One prominent activist was Lewis Hayden. Like the Crafts, Hayden and his wife Harriet were also escaped slaves. Hayden owned a clothing store in Boston. His home at 66 Phillips Street became a stop on the Underground Railroad.
Lewis Hayden harbored the Crafts on Beacon Hill for many months until they could see their way to finding a home of their own. We know from memoirs written by colleagues of his that he had in his basement of his house as many as 13 fugitive slaves at a time.
Boston was where William and Ellen decided to make a home with help from the thriving African-American community.
William Ellen Craft, by all accounts, were very happy in Boston. William established a business selling used furniture. He put his carpentry skills to good use, repairing furniture and making furniture as well. Ellen had always been a crack seamstress, and she, as she had done in the South, sewed for women, dresses, quilts, and she was able to set aside a little bit of money. And by all accounts, they were planning to begin a family soon.
But William and Ellen didn't just settle into domestic bliss.
Boston was considered the anti-slavery capital of the United States. And William and Ellen Craft jumped into this community of anti-slavery activists with both feet.
William and Ellen were recruited to go on anti-slavery speaking tours in and around Boston. These events were meant to convert white people to the anti-slavery cause. They took place in meeting houses and churches, and to begin, activists would make a speech about the evils of slavery. Then, formerly enslaved people would approach the podium to tell their firsthand accounts.
This would be the centerpiece of an anti-slavery meeting, to see actual African-Americans who had been in bondage, to hear those African-Americans talking about the horrors of being enslaved, sometimes even to literally witness the scars on their bodies.
When it was William and Ellen's turn to approach the podium, they stood up together, a young and attractive couple. William told their story of escape, while Ellen stood by him as a reminder of their love and their bond together.
Slavery relied on the assumption that African Americans were at best second-class human beings and at worst not human beings at all. So abolitionists attempted to overturn those notions by representing William and Ellen Craft in public, on stage, at these anti-slavery meetings as a respectable middle-class man, which meant assertive, articulate, vocal, opinionated, dominant, and a respectable middle-class woman, which meant deferential, demure, sometimes even a little bit of shy, polite, submissive.
William and Ellen's escape was so elaborate and daring, their desire to reach freedom so compelling that they won over audiences with their story. And that story was an important part of the abolitionist cause.
What abolitionists were doing was presenting African Americans as having an imagination, having the ability to dream, having an ability to think about and see into the future. These are qualities that we associate with humanity.
William and Ellen's story drew crowds of people, men and women, young and old, rich and poor.
Another group that appeared frequently in anti-slavery meetings, for lack of a better word, I have to say, were thugs. Sometimes these meetings would end in violent confrontations.
Hecklers might shout down the speakers on the stage, or a mob of men might try and bar the door to the hall, preventing the speakers from leaving. Being active in the anti-slavery movement was an enormous risk to William and Ellen. But there was another threat against their newfound freedom.
One never knew when organizing an anti-slavery meeting whether or not any of the participants might be bounty hunters, lurking in the background, hanging back, looking for an opportunity to snatch someone back into slavery.
The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 said that people who fled slavery could be returned at any time to their former master. As William and Ellen's fame grew, so did the risk that they'd be kidnapped and brought back to the South.
They were written about and followed very carefully in Freedom in both the British and American newspapers. And I might add that the Southern newspapers as well kept track of William and Ellen Craft in Freedom. Of course, Southerners, particularly Southern slaveholders, were outraged, not only at the fact that this valuable couple escaped, but they were outraged because Northerners seemed to collude or participate in keeping them free.
Ellen's former master, Robert Collins, knew exactly where she was and personally wrote articles in Southern newspapers about his desire to bring her back to his plantation.
And even though Robert Collins does, in writing, admit to his position that Ellen would be better off back in their home in terms of safety, security, comfort, he also admits that he values her, that she is his property. And that is the overarching argument for getting Ellen back in his writing, that first and foremost, he owns her.
Robert Collins wasn't just Ellen's former master. Their relationship was more complex. Ellen was the daughter of her first owner, James Smith. Although Ellen was a slave, she was also half-sister to Smith's other children.
Ellen was given to her half-sister as a wedding present at age 11. Her half-sister married Robert Collins, and that's how Robert Collins became her owner.
The man trying to hunt Ellen down, in modern terms, would be her brother-in-law. But Robert Collins didn't view Ellen as his sister. He saw her as his property. In the fall of 1850, Collins sent two bounty hunters to capture William and Ellen in Boston. A biracial group of activists called the Boston Vigilance Committee worked quickly to hide the couple. William was hidden away in Lewis Hayden's Beacon Hill residence, while Ellen was sequestered in an anti-slavery lawyer's home in Brookline.
For them, the worst nightmare of slavery was separation. So the idea of being separated, even for the purpose of saving their lives in freedom, as was done in Boston, was terrifying. It was horrific.
The couple moved separately from house to house until they were reunited again at Lewis Hayden's home on December 7, 1850. It was there that they were officially married in a Christian ceremony. The Reverend held a pistol just in case they were discovered. William and Ellen were no longer safe in Boston. With help from the Vigilance Committee, they fled to Halifax and then to Great Britain. It was in England that they wrote the narrative of their escape, running 1,000 miles for freedom. They didn't return to America for another 20 years.
No African American was safe in freedom. In the language of the day, for African Americans, being free was nominal freedom in name only. Because the reality was that if a white man said that you had been enslaved and you didn't have papers on your body to prove otherwise, you would go back to slavery, whether you were born in slavery or not.
The Crafts didn't feel it was safe to return until the Civil War was over and slavery had been abolished in all 50 states. In 1870, they brought their family, which now included 5 children, to a changed America. But the scars of slavery never really went away, for the Crafts or for America as a whole.
I teach about slavery, and this issue comes up in my classes all the time, how so modern and so contemporary William Ellen Craft's dealings with public authority as Black people, as a Black man and a Black woman seem. And I think that to know that history helps us to understand how deep these wounds have sunk into the African American communities around this country, from whence the skepticism, the suspicion, the fear surrounding police and other authorities comes. It doesn't come merely from the shootings that have occurred in the last few years, although that would be enough. The fear and the suspicion go back even further to the 200 plus years of slavery, where African Americans in order to protect our freedom and our lives, had to be skeptical about authority and also had to understand the reality that those who were sworn to protect and serve didn't always mean Black people. One way to begin a conversation about what is happening now is to talk about that history. And I think one reason why we seem so often stuck is because we haven't, as a country, been able to return to that history of slavery.
Within the craft's narrative of escape, empowerment, flight, and return, McCaskill sees an opportunity for Americans to learn about that history.
Freedom, autonomy, independence, agency, will. These are central to our identity as Americans ourselves. And if we can keep that in front of us, I think that we can find a way to solutions to some of the pressing questions that we're engaging with now.
This podcast is a production of the Commonwealth Museum, www.commonwealthmuseum.org. Today's podcast was produced and edited by me, Anna Fisher Pinkert. Our executive producer is Steve Kenny. Special thanks to Barbara McCaskill, Associate Professor of English and Co-Director of the Civil Rights Digital Library Initiative at the University of Georgia. Additional thanks to WUMB.